Picture the Mojave Desert in late summer. The heat comes off the flats in waves. The silence is complete enough that you can hear your own breathing. Out at the China Lake Naval Air Weapons Station in California, there is a landscape full of things the government is done with. Old test vehicles, old targets, old aircraft that flew their missions and got parked when the next thing came along. And sitting out there sometime around 1987, a man named Tony Mazzolini saw something that stopped him cold: a Boeing B-29 Superfortress. Complete, wings attached, fuselage intact, four right radial engines sitting in their nacelles, going nowhere, waiting. A full aircraft just left to the sun and the sand and the decades. Her name was Doc. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the Hangar on Radio Hangar. Today we're going out to the desert to bring something home. And the story of how that happened is one of the best things American aviation has done in the last 30 years. Before we get into it, today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now let's talk about what the B-29 actually was, because if you don't understand what these aircraft meant, you can't understand why someone would spend 16 years bringing one back. When Boeing started serious development on the Superfortress in the early 1940s, there was nothing like it anywhere in the world. Near 100 feet of wingspan, a pressurized crew cabin at a time when most bomber crews froze in open, unpressurized fuselages at high altitude. Four Wright R-3350 duplex Cyclone, radial engines, each one an 18-cylinder beast, making 2,200 horsepower, remote-controlled gun turrets operated by analog fire control computers, a cruise altitude of 33,000 feet, where Japanese interceptors had serious trouble reaching it. The B-29 was what happened when American industrial engineering decided that technology could solve problems that courage alone could not. The reality, of course, was messier than the blueprints. Those R-3350 engines ran hot, dangerously hot. The cowling design and the cooling systems were never quite adequate, and in the early days of B-29 operations out of the Marianas, engine fires were almost routine. Brigadier General Haywood Hansel, who commanded the early high-altitude raids against Japan, lost crews not to enemy fighters, but to their own power plants catching fire over the Pacific. Curtis LeMay took over the operation in January of 1945 and rewrote the playbook entirely. He took the aircraft down to low altitude, stripped out the defensive guns to save weight, loaded them with incendiary bombs, and sent them at night. The results were catastrophic for Japan's industrial cities. Tokyo, Osaka, Nagoya, Kobe, city after city burned, and then on August 6, 1945, a B-29 named Enola Gay carried a single weapon over Hiroshima. 3 days later, Boxcar did the same thing over Nagasaki. 6 days after that, Japan surrendered. Nearly 4,000 B-29s were built during the war, almost all of them in Wichita, Kansas. The Boeing plant there ran around the clock. Subassemblies came in from plants across the country. At the peak of production, they were completing a new aircraft every single day. The whole industrial weight of wartime America poured into that Wichita assembly line. The aircraft that would eventually be known as Doc rolled out of Wichita in 1944. It served with the Army Air Forces in the Pacific. It survived the war. After the armistice, like so many aircraft of its type, it went into a training role, helping mechanics and crew chiefs at Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma learn the complicated systems of a very complicated airplane. And then, in the mid-1950s, the Air Force was done with it. There were a lot of surplus B-29s after the war, and very little use for them. The Air Force had jet aircraft now. The big radial engine bombers were obsolete almost overnight. Most of the superfortresses were scrapped, their aluminum smelted down and turned into other things. A handful ended up in museums. Doc was transferred to China Lake. The Navy used China Lake for weapons testing, and retired aircraft served various purposes there as ground targets and firefighting training aids. Doc was simply parked, not destroyed, not torn apart, just left. And the Mojave Desert, which is brutal on human beings, is one of the finest preservatives in the world. Dry air means no rust. No humidity means structural integrity holds. After 30-plus years in that environment, Doc was weathered and faded and stripped of most of her interior equipment. But the bones were there. When Tony Mazzolini drove out to see it for himself, he was a Southwest Airlines flight engineer who had been around aviation his whole life. What he found stopped his breath. A complete, intact B-29 Superfortress, one of maybe a dozen surviving airframes in the world, sitting in the California dirt like a piece of forgotten furniture. He wanted to save it. More than that, he wanted to fly it again. Getting a piece of military hardware released from a Navy facility is not a fast process. The paperwork, the environmental assessments, the interagency reviews, the slow grinding machinery of the federal government moving at its own deliberate pace. The effort took years just to get to the point of formal acquisition. But Mazzolini was persistent, and along the way he connected with aviation enthusiasts in Wichita, with veterans who had built and flown B-29s, with a network of people who understood exactly what was at stake. The group that formed around Saving Doc called themselves Doc's Friends. It's a plain name and a perfect one, because what they were doing was exactly what you do for a friend, not for profit, not for fame, because it was right. Because this aircraft had done its job and deserved better than the desert. The formal acquisition was completed in the early 2000s, and the aircraft was transported to Wichita, Kansas, back home, back to the city that had built her 60 years before. There is something that is almost unbearably fitting about that. The aircraft had come from Wichita. It was going back to Wichita, and Wichita was going to give it back to the sky. What the restoration team found when they really got into the airframe was a mixed picture. The structure was in better shape than anyone had dared hope. The desert had been generous, but an aircraft sitting for decades needs everything examined, every rivet, every control cable, every structural frame and fuel fitting and control surface attachment point. The team worked methodically through the entire airframe, section by section, making calls on what could be restored, what needed to be replaced, what could be fabricated. The work was done largely by volunteers, retired airline mechanics who had spent careers working on large aircraft, active A&P technicians who came in on weekends, sheet metal workers who wanted to put their skills towards something that mattered. Some of them were people who had grown up hearing about B-29s and wanted to be part of keeping one alive. A few were veterans. One was a man in his 80s who had worked on the Wichita assembly line during the war, who had put his hands on this aircraft type when it was brand new, who came back to Wichita and put his hands on it again. Think about that for a moment. That is a 60-year thread connecting the war to the present day, and it runs right through the hands of one man standing in a hangar. The engines were their own chapter entirely, four Wright R-3350 duplex Cyclones, 18 cylinders each, that had been sitting without running for over 60 years. Parts for an engine that has not been in production since the 1950s do not come off a shelf. The team fabricated some components, sourced others from parts aircraft and from the network of R-3350 operators around the warbird community, and rebuilt others from scratch, using original manufacturing drawings. Each engine is essentially a project unto itself, and there are four of them. Plus the turbo superchargers, plus the cowl flaps and the oil coolers and all the cooling system plumbing that had given B-29 crews fits in the Pacific. Now here's where it gets interesting. Alongside the power plants, the team faced the challenge that every serious warbird restoration faces. How do you make it authentic and also legal and also safe to operate in modern airspace? The original instrumentation was long past serviceable. Some avionics systems had simply ceased to exist as an industry. The team had to make careful decisions about what to restore to original configuration, what to update for safety and regulatory compliance, and how to do all of it without losing the character of the aircraft. Every choice in that category is a negotiation between history and operational reality. The restoration took 16 years in total. 16 years is a long time, long enough for the original champions of the project to grow considerably older, long enough for some of them to not live to see it finished. Long enough for a second and third generation of volunteers to come in, people who had heard about Doc as a project and waited for the chance to be part of completing it. The restoration outlasted people, it outlasted the working careers of people who started it as middle-aged mechanics and finished it as retired ones. That is how you know something means something. On July 17, 2016, at Jabara Airport in Wichita, Kansas, Doc's four R-3350 engines were started for the first time in over 60 years. There were thousands of people there. Volunteers who had given years to the project, veterans, kids who had grown up with photographs of these aircraft and had never heard one run, and when those engines turned over, coughed, caught, and settled into the rolling, syncopated thunder that is unique to a big radial engine at idle, the crowd went quiet, not a turbine whine. Not the sound of anything modern. That deep, irregular chest-thumping rhythm that means a lot of large pistons are moving in a coordinated series, connected to propellers that are starting to find their bite in the air. It is a sound that connects directly to some part of you that knows it is hearing something extraordinary. Doc taxied out, rolled down the runway, and lifted off over Wichita. 71 years after the end of the war, it was built to fight. Over the streets where the assembly workers had walked, over the neighborhoods where the test pilots and the engineers and the Boeing shift workers had lived their lives and built an air force. The aircraft climbed up into the Kansas summer sky and flew. There were people crying on the ramp. I would not have been embarrassed to be one of them. Doc is based now at the B-29 and B-24 Museum at Eisenhower National Airport in Wichita. It tours air shows around the country and offers rides to veterans and aviation enthusiasts who want to feel what it was like to sit inside that aircraft when it was the sharpest edge of American air power. The rides book out fast. There are veterans who flew B-29s in Korea, which was the last conflict in which the type flew operationally, who climb the boarding ladder and get quiet when they step inside. I have heard the argument made by reasonable people that the cost of restoring and maintaining airworthy warbirds could serve the educational mission better if redirected somewhere else, that a static display accomplishes the same thing at a fraction of the expense. I understand the math. I do not accept the conclusion. When you stand on a ramp and feel four R-3350 engines in your chest, when you watch that machine rotate off the runway and climb out against the sky, you are not receiving information. You're understanding something at a level that no photograph and no museum placard can reach. You are feeling the scale of what these aircraft were, what they demanded of the people who flew them, what it cost in human ingenuity and labor and sacrifice to build the force that ended that war. You cannot get that from a sign. You have to hear it. And because of 16 years of work and 300,000 volunteer hours and the stubbornness of people who refuse to let that aircraft die in the California desert. You still can. Sources for today include reporting from Aviation Week, documentation from the Boeing Company archives, and the Doc's Friends organization at docsfriends.com, where the full restoration history is documented and where they are always looking for support. Worth your time.
I'm Tail Dragger on the hangar. Fly safe out there. And if you ever get the chance to hear those engines light off in person, go.